Okay, folks, here we go. I'm Dave Cook from the Monitor. Thanks for coming. Our guest today is Douglas Elmendorf, Director of the Congressional Budget Office. This is his fourth visit with our group. His last was in June of 2012. Before I launch into an introduction of our guest, let me take a moment to note the passing of Godfrey Sperling, who everyone called by his boyhood name, Budge. Budge started the Breakfast Group in 1966, and during the next 35 years, hosted 3,241 breakfasts, including sessions with Presidents Ford, Carter, Reagan, and Clinton. Budge and his late wife, Betty, were much-loved members of the Monitor family, and they will be missed. And now on to today's breakfast, number 3,793, for you trivia buffs. Mr. Elmendorf became director of the CBO in January 2009 and brings an impressive background to the assignment. His undergraduate degree is from Princeton, Phi Beta Kappa. His master's and doctorates in economics are from Harvard, where some of the biggest names in U.S. economic policy, including Larry Summers, served on his dissertation committee. Before being named CBO director, our guest taught at Harvard, worked at the Council of Economic Advisors and the Federal Reserve Board, and served as Deputy Assistant Treasury Secretary for Economic Policy. Just before his selection to head the CBO, Dr. Elmendorf was a senior fellow in the Economic Studies program at Brookings, all that, and he's the proud father of twin daughters. Thus ended the biographical portion of the program. Now on to the ritual recitation of ground rules. As always, we're on the record. Please, no live blogging or tweeting. In short, no filing of any kind while the breakfast is underway. Our goal is to offer a moment, or even two, for thought and reflection. There's no embargo when the session ends. Finally, if you'd like to ask a question, please do the traditional thing and send me a subtle, non-threatening signal, and I'll happily call in one and all. We're going to start off by offering our guests the opportunity to make some opening comments. Then we'll move to questions from around the table. Thanks again for doing this.
Thank you very much. It is great to be back. This is always an interesting and challenging hour for me. It's good to be here. I wanted to make just two points to start with. The first is we passed around a Xerox page out of our report that shows what I think is the most important figure in the report that didn't make it into the slides for our press conference yesterday morning. This figure shows large budget categories as a share of GDP over the past 40 years on average, and then in this current fiscal year, 2013, and 25 years from now, in 2038. And you can see in this picture points that I did mention yesterday, Social Security spending and spending for the major healthcare programs has grown over time and will grow rapidly over the coming quarter century. In sharp contrast, all other non-interest spending of the federal government is actually a smaller share of GDP this year than it has been on average over the past 40 years. And under current law, will shrink rapidly in the future relative to GDP. By 2020 or so, that category of other spending, everything except for Social Security and the healthcare programs and interest on the debt, will be a smaller share of GDP than it's been at any point since the 1930s. And the bottom line of that comparison is that the upward pressure on federal spending relative to the size of the economy comes not from general growth in the size of the federal government, but from growth in just a handful of the largest programs, Social Security, Medicare, and Medicaid. And then over time, from the rising cost of servicing the government's debt. And the top right set of bars show net interest payments that are quite low right now, because despite the large debt, because interest rates are low. But as rates return to more normal levels, and then over time, as debt grows again, we think interest payments will become an ever-growing share of the federal budget. The second point I wanted to make was a topic that came up only briefly yesterday morning, but then as I was reading the coverage later in the day and the blog postings and so on, it seemed to get a fair amount of attention, which is the role of the Affordable Care Act in this growth of healthcare spending. There is a box in Chapter 1 of the report that decomposes the growth in federal spending on healthcare programs as a share of GDP over the next 10 years and the next 25 years into three categories of factors. One is the aging of the population, the retirement of the baby boom generation. The second is rising healthcare costs per person. And the third is the expansion of federal subsidies for health insurance for lower-income people through the Affordable Care Act. The expansion of subsidies accounts for about half of the growth in federal spending on the healthcare programs relative to GDP over the next decade, and about one quarter over the next 25 years. And the reason it's a smaller share over the 25 years than the 10 years is because the effects of the coverage expansion hit mostly during the next few years, whereas the effects of the retirement of the baby boomers and the rising cost per person accumulate and compound over the entire 25 years. But the other thing to recognize here is that this is a decomposition of just the coverage expansions from the Affordable Care Act. The Affordable Care Act also included large cuts in Medicare spending relative to prior law. We didn't try to break those out in this report because it's very hard to do that. The coverage expansions are essentially new things for which there is no actual data yet. So we're still projecting those along the lines of how we did the original cost estimate. It's a separate part of our estimating process. But the changes in Medicare are just interwoven with all pre-existing Medicare law at this point. So there's no real way to separate those out. But you should recognize that this is not the effects of the Affordable Care Act on healthcare spending that we're showing. It's the effects of these coverage expansions. The Act also, as I said, brought down Medicare spending. So those are just two things I thought worth starting with. But I'm here mostly just to hear what your questions are, try to answer them.
Let me ask you one or two, and in the spirit of Mr. Sperling, I'll start with sort of a philosophical question. He was famous for doing that, and hoping that the guests would then trip themselves up and make news. You said on your blog, and also at yesterday's briefing, that, quote, the fundamental budgetary challenge has hardly been addressed. And you talked about how difficult the choices are. So my question is, given how tough the choices are, do you expect the budgetary challenges to be addressed in the absence of an action forcing crisis, or do you expect to leave your job in January of 2015 with the problem unresolved?
CBO has a longstanding policy of not making political forecasts. We make economic forecasts, we make budget forecasts, we don't make political forecasts.
I was hoping the fruit plate would trick you. Okay.
No, I don't know what will happen in the Congress in terms of the budget. I think most members of Congress understand the challenge that CBO has been talking about for many years. I think one obstacle to progress is I'm not sure that members of the public understand the nature of the challenge. I think there are many people who in the country who don't like federal spending in the abstract and don't want to pay more in taxes to support more federal spending in the abstract, but who actually put great value on the benefits they receive from Social Security, Medicare, and Medicaid, as well as other parts of the government budget. And it turns out that a very large share of current spending, more than all of the projected growth in federal spending, is attributable to a comparative handful of programs. And programs for which almost all of the money is written in checks that go outside the Beltway very quickly. The administrative costs of these programs are quite low. The Affordable Care Act, as I noted, has cut back on payments to providers relative to the prior law. So there aren't a lot of easy ways to cut back spending for those programs. Not a lot of legislation is voted out of congressional committees to cut benefits for Social Security or Medicare or Medicaid, with the exception of legislation to repeal the Affordable Care Act in the past few years.
So you get,
so I think it's a hard.
Does it make you? How do you keep from being a pessimist? Or maybe you are a pessimist and you just won't tell us.
I'm not a pessimist. I'm not a pessimist because I think these problems are solvable. I think the choices are hard, but we are a country with tremendous resources of all sorts. And the problems that we face here are less significant than problems faced by some countries in Europe right now. So I think they can be solved, and I think the solutions can be helped through the sort of analysis that CBO does.
Last question for me. I want to ask you about your view of the economic climate in 2014 when there's obviously a congressional election. Mark Zandi of Moody's Analytics thinks that starting next year, real GDP will grow more than 3% and that average monthly job gains will exceed 200,000. How does that mesh with your view of the economic outlook for 2014?
So we did our last economic forecast last winter, and I don't want to put a precise number down now because we'll be moving into our forecast for next year soon. But we have been expecting for some time, for a long time, a pickup in the economy. And we still think that will start to show very clearly next year. The The financial crisis, the bursting of the housing bubble, the recession cast a very long shadow on the economy. But there are a number of ways one can observe where that shadow appears to be fading a little bit. So the housing sector is improving. Households' balance sheets have improved. Credit supply is picking up. So we think that it's been a very long and slow process, and longer and slower than we thought it would be. But we think that the economy is healing. And in particular, in addition to the underlying strengthening of the economy, under current law, the drag from federal fiscal policy will diminish a great deal next year. So this year, we said that we predicted growth in the GDP over the four quarters of this year would be about 1.5%. And we said it would be 1.5 percentage points faster than that were it not for the effects of sequestration and expiration of tax cuts that happened. For next year, we think the fiscal drag, rather than being on the order of 1.5%, will be on the order of 0.5%. So there'll be notably less fiscal drag and an improvement in underlying economic conditions. We think the economy will grow noticeably more rapidly next year than this year.
We're going to go to Damian Paletta, Steve Deenan, and Rick Klein to start. Damian and John.
Can you give us a sense, if there is a government shutdown, what does that do to the budget, number one? And number two, what logistically happens to the government? What shuts down, what doesn't shut down?
Well, at the moment, there are no appropriations for any federal agencies beginning October 1st. So all of the government shuts down except the parts that are deemed essential services. And I think there's a great deal of latitude in that determination for the president. So how much of the government stops working and how much keeps working is actually not something that we have a good basis for predicting. I think the effects on the economy depend very much on the length and breadth of the shutdown. If the shutdown lasted just a few days or lasts a little longer but we're confined to only a part of the government, then the economic effects could be small. On the other hand, if a shutdown persisted for a long period of time across a large swath of the budget, then the effects could be much larger, both directly and indirectly. Directly in terms of the federal employees who wouldn't be getting paid, the contractors who wouldn't be getting contracts, and so on. But also potentially indirectly in terms of the confidence of households and businesses in the government's ability to manage its affairs. And those confidence effects are would be particularly hard for us to predict, but are potentially as large or larger than the direct effects on spending.
But it doesn't necessarily save money, right, in the budget?
It doesn't necessarily save money. That depends a lot on what the Congress and the President do after the shutdown ends. So in some cases in the past, I think federal employees have received their back salaries. And if the appropriations for the next fiscal year are no different for the year as a whole than they would have been otherwise, then agencies will probably spend that money not at the beginning of October, but at some later point. So it may have no effect on the overall spending of the government. And it potentially makes the government's operations less efficient. So we have now started to prepare for the possibility of a shutdown at CBO. And that is taking time and energy that we would otherwise be spending in serving the Congress more directly. Of course, CBO is a very small and very simple part of the government. So I imagine that at agencies that are more larger and much more complicated, that the planning for a shutdown is a much more involved business. So I think the possibility of a shutdown is a factor making the government less efficient in its operations. I think the uncertainty about what next year's funding will be makes the government less efficient in its operations. Again, in our own small case, just as an anecdote, the level of funding that's been approved for us by the Senate Appropriations Committee and the House Appropriations Subcommittee that deals with us are 10% apart in the dollar amount. It's very hard to know what hiring to do, what projects to start, given a 10% range in the number amount of money and essentially the number of people we might be able to have next year. And those problems must be much, much larger, again, in agencies that are larger and more complicated than CBO.
Steve,
but I think the uncertainty is
costly. Excuse me, I apologize.
Yes.
Steve?
I want to follow up on two things that you've already talked about. One is, you said the fiscal drag will drop to about 0.5% of GDP. Does that mean that the effects of this, what's the effect there? What's happening? Is there any sequesters? Not, I mean, it's the same dollar amount. Why is the fiscal drag less than it would otherwise be? And then also, Is it possible to write a bill that actually, or write into a spending bill, defunding Obamacare? How would that look? And is it possible to actually write something that cuts it off entirely?
So on the first question, the effects of federal fiscal policy on the economy depend on economic growth in a given year depend on the changes in taxes and spending in that year or leading up to that year, the little lag in the effect on the economy. So what produced the 1.5 percentage points of drag this year was the expiration of the, in our estimation, was the expiration of the payroll tax cut, the expiration of lower tax rates on high-income people, and the cuts in federal spending relative to the previous year. As we look ahead from 2013 to 2014, there isn't the same amount of expiring tax provisions. There are some under current law. For example, some of the accelerated depreciation allowances for businesses will expire at the end of this year. But the expirations of tax cuts are smaller, and the difference in the level of funding for discretionary programs is smaller.
Have you done a calculation on, with those sequestrations specifically, how much higher economic growth?
We did a calculation in a letter to Congressman Van Hollen a couple of months ago that was a particular experiment of turning off some of the sequestration at the end of fiscal year 2013 and in fiscal year 2014. That particular experiment wouldn't apply exactly today because it's too late to have that effect in fiscal year 2013. So we've not released a specific number for throughout the sequestration right now. You then asked a question about defunding the Affordable Care Act. It's certainly possible to put into an appropriations bill restrictions on how federal employees use the money that's provided. That's a standard feature of appropriations bills. I think the challenge for the Affordable Care Act is that if one is defunding the administration of the act, but leaving in place the features of permanent law that expand Medicaid eligibility, that create a right to tax credits in insurance exchanges, then you have essentially a conflict in the instructions to federal administrators. On one hand, if you leave, say, the tax credits for subsidies through insurance exchanges in law, then people have a right to collect those tax credits. If you simultaneously tell the Internal Revenue Service not to administer those tax credits, then you've ended up in a rather unusual circumstance. And just how that would play out, I think, is not entirely clear. And we've done a number of estimates over the last few years of different forms of defunding temporarily and permanently and defunding different pieces of the bill. Again, do you mean defunding the insurance exchanges and Medicaid expansion, or also defunding the Medicare changes in the Affordable Care Act? So the answers differ a lot depending on the specific legislation.
Could you write it to stop the exchanges? What would be the conflict on the exchanges? Is the law written, am I still entitled to subsidies even though the IRS is told not to deliver them? Is that one of the conflicts?
Well, so you could write, so when I thought about defunding, what I interpreted that to mean was just saying you couldn't use the money in the appropriations to administer something.
Right.
You also could just pass a repeal of the Affordable Care Act or repeal of some pieces of the Affordable Care Act, and then you would avoid this sort of conflict I'm describing. And you could do that together with setting appropriations. That's up to the Congress.
We're going next to Rick Klein, John Wiseman, Kelsey Snow, Neil Monroe, Duell McManus, and Eric Wasson. Rick.
So the president likes to say that, though you may not know it, that the deficit is falling at a faster rate than any time, I think, since World War II.
Yes.
And a piece of that certainly has to do with the stimulus. A piece of that has to do, I would assume, and I want your take on this, with how much deficit reduction and long-term benefit are we going to derive from this kind of stumbling into tough choices with continuing resolutions, with sequestration? Have those moves in the divided government in the last 2 years made a significant dent in the long-term outlook?
Well, deficit is falling rapidly. I gave a talk last week where I looked at the revisions to our projections from early 2011 to May of this year and looked at the categories that are up or down. I think the policy actions that have been taken have mattered, but in complicated ways. So take tax policy. Under current law, as it stood a few years ago, the 2001 and 2003 tax cuts expired. The alternative minimum tax was set to cover many more people than it has covered in the past. So relative to our current law baseline, the actions of the Congress and the President have reduced revenues by a lot in the future. That's made the baseline projections worse. And you can see that by comparing this year's extended baseline in this long-term budget outlook to last year's extended baseline. On the other hand, if your benchmark is what I think it is for many members of Congress, which was an extension of all of those tax provisions, relative to that, Congress and the President decided not to extend tax cuts for higher-income people. So what your benchmark is for the starting point matters a tremendous amount. I think on the spending side, the question for discretionary spending is the extent to which the original caps in the Budget Control Act and now the lower caps are actually adhered to. Right? Discretionary appropriations are set on a year-by-year basis. So when Congress writes a law that says appropriations in some future year will total X dollars, they will not have decided how the cutbacks will actually be allocated across specific programs. And we can see already that neither the House nor the Senate has moved a full set of appropriations bills for fiscal year 2014. So even how they will actually meet the caps in 2014 is not clear, much less how they meet the caps in 2023. So whether the caps and other provisions of the Budget Control Act ultimately improve the budget outcome depends on whether Congress and the President stick with those provisions or substitute provisions of comparable deficit reduction, or if it turns out those constraints are so tight. And as I said, by 2020, this part of the budget will be much smaller than it's been in decades. How they react to that will determine whether the actions they've taken so far really are reducing the deficit or not.
So what's the biggest driver in the deficit falling rapidly? Is it economic growth and the increase in tax revenues around that? Is it changes in tax policy? Is it spending cuts?
It is a combination of improving economy and the changes in policy. And I don't know offhand how much credit goes to each. We publish on a regular basis estimates of a cyclically adjusted budget deficit, and then you can see in that report how much is improvement from the improving economy and how much is other factors. But I don't remember offhand what the numbers are.
Jonathan?
When you're calculating the percentage of the health care increases that are attributable to the Affordable Care Act, how do you treat the offsetting tax increases and Medicare cuts in those assessments? I mean, is that embedded in that 25% figure?
No, so that's the point I was trying to make, was that figure is just about the effects of the expansions of insurance coverage, mm-hmm. So the Medicaid expansion and the subsidies through insurance exchanges and the features related to that. We've not tried to take out, to sort of decompose the portion of health cost growth, which is reduced because of the changes in Medicare provisions. Mm-hmm. Because it's not really possible now. I mean, without a tremendous amount of very weird analytic work, the changes in the Medicare payment rates have now been in place for a number of years. So, and the future, and the rules going forward, as I said, are just fully intertwined with all the prior rules on Medicare payments. So it's even hard now to think about what it means. You know, if the Affordable Care Act had not taken effect 3 years ago, where would we be today? It's a very complicated business.
And CBO still believes that over the 10-year window, the Affordable Care Act actually is a deficit reducer. Do you have a 25-year
yes.
forecast on that?
So what we've done for the Affordable Care Act, on both when it was being put into law and as efforts have been made to repeal it, is to offer estimates dollar terms for the first decade and rougher for the second decade, so not quite 25 years.
Right.
The last time we did an estimate of the effects of repealing the Affordable Care Act, we thought that repeal would increase the deficit in the first decade and would increase the deficit in the second decade.
Kelsey?
Yes. I want to talk to you a little bit about tax reform. The Senate budget, they called for nearly $1 trillion in new revenue, and that figure's been of a considerable amount of debate at this point, with Democrats who are primarily being supported in the number. I wonder if you think that $1 trillion would be enough to address some of the spending side concerns that you're talking about, or if tax reform could serve the budget picture in a different way and in a better way.
I think having a more efficient tax system would be a good thing for the economy, whatever level of revenue we ultimately decided to collect. What revenue we decide to collect is not above my pay grade. CBO doesn't make policy recommendations. That's up to the members of Congress and citizens acting through their members of Congress. If revenues were increased by $1 trillion over the coming decade, that would make a sizable dent in the deficits that we project. We offered an illustrative policy in this report with a production deficit of $2 trillion over this coming decade, and we did not specify whether those would be on the tax side or the spending side. But a reduction of $2 trillion over this coming decade that was then continued beyond the decade at the same share of GDP that we would have in the 10th year, that sort of policy would keep the ratio of debt to GDP close to its current value throughout the next 25 years. So we, under current law, we think we'll end up at 100% of GDP. Under this $2 trillion continued policy of deficit reduction, debt ends up at 60-something percent of GDP. And we had an illustrative policy with $4 trillion of deficit reduction over the decade and then continued beyond. That would push debt back down by 25 years from now to a little below where it was in 2007. So that gives a sense of the orders of magnitude. But whether this should happen through an increase in taxes or reduction in spending depends on people's choices about what they want the government to do. The problem we have now is that we're choosing to have certain level of benefits and certain level of taxes that are just not consistent.
Neil?
Thanks for doing this. Okay. In terms of spending, a lot is driven by just the scale of the population. You have 392 million people in 2038. UN says 383. Deutsche Bank says 378. How much of your growing expenses are due to the population increase over the next several decades? And do you include the population increase created by the Senate immigration bill? 33 million in 10 years, 46 million in 20.
So the effects of a higher population on the budget depends on where those people are coming from. So if population is higher because we have a higher birth rate, and then we have more workers, that's good for the budget, at least during the period in which they're coming into the labor force. The population is higher because you have more people living longer in retirement, then that's good for people, but bad for the budget because they're collecting benefits. So I don't know, I didn't even know the differences you noted, and I certainly don't know how we differ in terms of the composition, the age composition of our projections. That's what would determine the sort of budgetary effect. These projections do not incorporate the effects of the Senate bill because these projections are conditioned on current law, and that bill is not in law. As you know, we said that that law, if enacted, would be good for the economy and good for the budget, importantly by bringing in people of working age who would then contribute through taxes to the federal budgetary outlook.
Doyle?
I want to re-ask a very old and still dumb question, but it's still a good question, and then a new and probably equally dumb question. The old question is, okay, it's hard for the general public to look at the Affordable Care Act and say, spending is going to go up on subsidies, it's going to go up on Medicaid, but you're saying it will reduce the deficit over the first decade and second decade. So please explain, get us again out of the cognitive dissonance that we are thrown into, and have your projections changed on the deficit reduction effect. The newer question is, have you worked out what the potential effect would be of a delay in implementation for a year of the ACA would be?
So the Affordable Care Act had a whole lot of provisions. The ones that I think have gotten the most attention in some ways are the provisions that would expand the government's support for health insurance for lower-income people. And those provisions cost the government money, a good deal of money. But the Affordable Care Act also included cuts in spending for Medicare and increases in tax revenues. And the framers of that legislation picked those provisions to net out as an improvement, a small improvement in the overall budget balance. So it's not I also get this question of how could it be. It's not a mystery. One can add spending in some categories. If one also subtracts other spending and raises revenues, then one can end up with a net zero or a net improvement or a net deficit, depending on how you juggle those pieces. Our projections of the effects of the Affordable Care Act have not changed very much over the past 3 years. For the coverage expansions, which, as I said, we still estimate sort of separately because there aren't any real incoming data yet, we've shown regularly on our website pictures so one can look at the year-by-year projections of the effects of those expansions, and they've not moved very much. What is true, of course, is that the 10-year budget window has shifted a number of years out. So more years, more expensive years are included. But it's also true that more years of larger Medicare savings are included and more years of tax increases are included. So the last time we did an estimate of the effects of the entire piece of the prior Affordable Care Act in terms of repeal, we don't really estimate it anymore because it's in the law. We estimate repeal sometimes. That estimate of repeal still showed an increase in deficits from repeal. In other words, that the Affordable Care Act itself was reducing deficits.
And delay.
Well, it depends. The effects of delay depend, again, on exactly what it is that one is delaying. And I'm not trying to be difficult about this, but we get a lot of pieces of legislation that mean different things by that. If one delays the insurance coverage expansion, then one can save a fair amount of money. Even then, it depends just how one does it. But if you look at our projections of the Affordable Care Act, coverage expansions, those expansions by themselves, we think will cost the federal government roughly $50 billion in fiscal year 2014 and $83 billion in fiscal year 2015 and $130 billion in 2016. So if one pushes that set of spending further off, that saves a fair amount of money. On the other hand, if by delay one also means not imposing the tax collections, the extra tax collections under the Act, or changing in some way the Medicare, changes in Medicare payments, then one could get a different answer.
Paul?
I think that your deficit projection changed quite a bit between earlier this year and your most recent
So I don't remember, I'm afraid, I didn't bring our February projection. In May, we projected the deficit for this fiscal year would be $642 billion. We now think that revenues will be less than we had expected. Spending may be about the same as we had expected. So we think deficit will be still under $700 billion, but not as low as the $642. I don't remember if we had something different to say in February.
Okay.
I think within a year, I'm sorry to say, that's not an unusually large error in the projection. So we've just gotten corporate tax receipt information for the receipts this week, and those corporate tax receipts look a little weaker than we've been expecting. But corporate tax receipts are a very volatile creature. The tax rate, not the statutory rates, but the effective tax rate, the actual receipts relative to corporate profits, as best they're measured, bounces around a lot. It had fallen a great deal and is on the rebound. So it's very hard to get these numbers exactly right. We need to remember the deficit is the difference between two much larger numbers. So fairly small errors in projecting spending or revenues can lead to large percentage errors in the deficit. And what I'm talking about here is a percentage error in the deficit of 10% or so. So that happens.
So my question is, clearly the farther out you go, the more uncertain the projections are because of economic growth and other factors. So, I mean, to what extent should lawmakers make long-term plans based on long-term projections given the increasing uncertainty of long-term projections?
So budget projections are very uncertain. Nobody should think otherwise. We took some pains in this long-term budget outlook to write an entire chapter about the uncertainty of these projections because the uncertainty gets bigger as one goes further out. And part of the reason that we focus on the next 25 years rather than years even beyond that is because we think our crystal balls get really unbelievably hazy as one gets into those future decades. So what we tried to do in this chapter on uncertainty was to quantify some of the sources of uncertainty, differences in productivity growth or interest rates or healthcare spending, to talk about some sources of uncertainty that we weren't able to quantify, and then to talk briefly about what policymakers might do in response to that uncertainty. We talked about two sorts of things policymakers could do as alternatives or complements. One is to adjust federal programs so that they are responsive to changes in demographic or economic conditions. And the classic example of this would be indexing Social Security eligibility age to life expectancy. And we're not advocating that, but this is an issue that analysts raise. If the retirement age were indexed to longevity, that would insulate the federal budget to some extent from the effects of uncertainty about how long people live. But to be clear, and we were clear in the report, it insulates the federal budget in some ways by shifting that risk to the future potential beneficiaries. This is not a free lunch. It's a choice one could make. So there are ways to construct federal programs that would make the budget less sensitive to certain sorts of uncertainty. I think the second thing we talk about is that one could do a sort of precautionary saving in the way that we might as households, which is to have a run a lower deficit and accumulate less debt to guard against the risk of another financial crisis and a sharp recession of the sort we've seen in the past several years. And we emphasize here the one of the dangers of having debt at the level we have it at is that we went between 2007 and 2011 or 12 or 13 up debt from 35% of GDP or so to more than 70% of GDP. If we were to hit another crisis of that sort, starting at 70% of GDP, then we would be faced with very, very hard choices. And this is what's happened, I think, in some European countries.
Anybody who hasn't had one who would like one? Yes, Brian.
Okay, this is off topic, kind of. I understand you're originally from Poughkeepsie. I don't know if you have any connections to Poughkeepsie still.
I have a few.
If Poughkeepsie connections influenced your career choice.
Or your forecasts.
Yeah, or your forecasts, yeah.
I grew up in Poughkeepsie, New York. I have very fond feelings for Poughkeepsie. If you haven't been, there's this wonderful railroad bridge over the Hudson River that burned in a fire when I was just a kid. And they stopped, they didn't repair it, and they stopped running trains over it. And then they decided, the community, to rebuild it as a pedestrian walkway. And you can walk across the river at this tremendous height because it's up at the top, essentially, of the sides of the valley. So if you haven't been to Poughkeepsie, I recommend you go. And you just walk across this bridge. I don't think... I learned a lot from my parents and the people in Poughkeepsie, my teachers, but I don't think they particularly steered me into economics.
Okay, but did it influence your career choice?
Like wanting to get out of Poughkeepsie and make money, or
I don't. No, actually, I did not. I like Poughkeepsie. I think. I don't think it influenced my career choice. I fell into economics as a freshman at Princeton. Alan Blinder taught introductory macroeconomics. And Harvey Rosen taught introductory microeconomics, and I thought it was just the most interesting thing I could imagine. And that selected me as one of a very small group of people who feel that way, and that's what guided my career choice.
And which high school did you graduate from?
Spackenkill High School.
Thank you.
The natural follow-up is, are you a Yankees fan or a Mets fan?
So I was a Yankee fan growing up. I'm now a Nationals fan.
Can I ask you two policy questions? One, in terms of running out of cash, you gave a forecast yesterday, sometime between late October and mid-November for the government.
Yes, the end of October and mid-November.
And just a minute or two ago, you talked about tax receipts being exceptionally volatile. Question, what sort of confidence do you have that the cash will hold until late October or mid-November? Because, as you know, Lou said yesterday in a speech that we're relying on investors from all over the world to continue to hold U.S. bonds. Every Thursday, we roll over approximately $100 billion. If bondholders decide they wanted to be repaid, obviously, life would get difficult in a hurry. What's the degree of risk in your forecast?
So our projection is that, let me start. The Treasury Secretary wrote a letter a few weeks ago that said he thought that the Treasury would run out of borrowing room in mid-October and have about $50 billion in cash on hand. And that projection seems quite plausible to us. Given the usual sorts of cash flows that would occur after that point, we think the government would run out of cash sometime between the end of October and mid-November. But there can be unusual, and even that statement, of course, we're offering a range because it is uncertain. But beyond that, there can be unusual cash flows, unusual demands. We don't have any capacity to predict that. Our involvement in the government's cash flow is essentially zero. We follow it because we're trying to keep track of what's happening to spending and revenues. But issues about how they manage the cash flow, what the risks are, what the tools are that they have, are questions that need to go to the Treasury, not to us.
As you know, reporters lie, and I lied about doing a second question. We're actually going to go to James Pellini and then to Eleanor Clift. James.
Hey, James. So, as you know, the administration is negotiating two very large trade agreements, TPP and the EU deal. And the message is that these will have a substantial positive economic impact. How does the CBO score trade agreements, and do you think that they have a positive economic impact, and what scale are we talking about here?
I think the last time that CBO did an economic analysis of a trade agreement was for NAFTA. For other agreements, we will do estimates of changes in tariffs or something else, but not so sort of the direct budgetary implications, but not do economic analyses. There's no reason why we couldn't. It just hasn't been the highest priority for us to do. So we have not done analyses of these two agreements that you talk about. So I can't speak directly to them. In general, trade agreements are positive forces for the U.S. economy, in part, of course, because the ones that we end up agreeing to are ones that have been constructed to have some positive effects for the U.S. economy. Not suggesting that we should just take any agreement that's offered to us, it might not have that effect. But in general, I think trade agreements have had positive effects on the U.S. economy. I think there have generally been small positive effects, but I can't speak to those bills.
Eleanor?
I can't handle the weight, so maybe you address this. But as the Congress seems to be barreling towards these confrontations that would have really dire impact on the economy, do the leaders and their staff consult you, and do these numbers affect anything?
I can't speak specifically to our interactions with the Congress, but most definitely, yes, we are consulted by the leaders of the House and the Senate, by the budget committees, by other committees in the Congress, as they consider legislation, and including as they consider how to deal with appropriations and increasing the debt ceiling. I think that the analysis matters. Certainly, members of Congress seem very eager to have it when we talk with them. But ultimately, decisions rest with the members, not with us, as it should be.
Well, the Republican narrative is that the deficit is so dire, it's destroying the economy, and yet the figures you present don't suggest that it's kind of a manageable situation. When you hear some of the statements that are made, do you wonder where they come from?
I don't comment on statements made by members of Congress. I think our projections, both the 10-year projections in the spring and the ones for the longer term we released yesterday, show that the federal budget is a very important problem, but not necessarily an urgent one, in the sense that the interest rates that the federal government is currently paying are quite low. The deficit is falling now. But one of the most important pieces of advice, I think, to people in their personal lives and people running their own affairs is not to neglect the important problems while chasing after the urgent ones. And one of the purposes of the long-term budget outlook is to make sure that policymakers aren't just trying to address the fiscal issues of today or next year or the year after, but are trying to look ahead as best we can help them look ahead and address fiscal problems over a longer term. So it is certainly true, and I led off with this yesterday, deficits are falling rapidly, and that does give us some breathing room. But I think it would be a mistake to take that as a sort of all clear signal. There are a lot of good reasons that we've written about for trying to make decisions about what the future policies will be. Even if Congress decided not to have those policies take effect right away because of concerns about weakening the economic recovery, but even if you want them to take effect later, it's better to make the decisions sooner because it gives people more time to plan and adjust. It gives more time to phase in policies. That's what Congress wants to do. So I think it's hard. We do a lot of giving pros and cons for different choices. I think it's hard to think of a disadvantage to deciding what to do soon, and easy to think of advantages to deciding what to do soon. The pace at which the changes are phased in, there's a harder trade-offs there. But there are big advantages to deciding soon what should be done.
And do you want to, before we go to Jim Rowley, Linda Feldman, and Brian Tumulty, do you want to offer an opinion on when those changes should be phased in, or is that something you leave to Congress?
Well, what we've noted a number of times, including yesterday, is that when Congress is deciding how quickly to make changes in policy, there is a trade-off. The more slowly those changes are phased in, then the more debt it accumulates, and the sharper the changes that will be needed in the future. On the other hand, the more quickly those changes are phased in, the less time people have to plan and adjust, and the worse it is for this current economic recovery. And in particular, we noted yesterday that the negative short-term effects of raising taxes or cutting spending in order to reduce deficits are particularly acute under the current conditions, where the Federal Reserve has pushed interest rates down to zero, because now the Federal Reserve can't really adjust to offset any short-term fiscal drag. Whereas reductions in deficits a few years from now, by which point interest rates will have climbed back from zero, up from zero, we think, under those circumstances, the Federal Reserve could then adjust its policy in a way that would offset some of the short-term costs of fiscal drag.
Jim?
You talked about the need, even though you aren't going to respond to a question about whether we need more revenue from taxes, the need to overhaul the tax code to prevent the long-term changes in the tax incentives and bracketing that would occur if the tax code would remain unchanged.
So as one point I made earlier worth emphasizing is that whatever level of revenue the country wants to collect, it's better to do it in a more efficient way. A very, very widespread view among analysts that our current tax code is not very efficient. And that means there are opportunities for tax reform to strengthen the economy. The other point you're noting is that under current law, tax brackets are indexed for inflation through most of the tax code, but not indexed for growth in real incomes. So over time, over, say, the 25 years of this long-term outlook, with real income growth, people will be pushed into higher tax brackets. And in our revenue chapter, we talk about the increase in average tax rates, which is sort of your taxes paid as a share of your income, the burden you face, but also the changes, the increases in marginal tax rates, which are the tax rates on an additional dollar earned or saved, and affects how much you work and save. And so under the current tax law, marginal tax rates and average tax rates both rise over time in a significant way. And if the Congress wanted to prevent that from happening, then they would have to make some change. It's complicated. One can bring down marginal tax rates to some extent by broadening the tax base, and of course that's a standard feature of many tax reform proposals. The average tax rates, that really is just a matter of what share of income is being paid in tax revenue. So to bring those down, one needs to, while keeping the debt on a sustainable path, one would then need to make even larger changes in spending.
Just to follow up quickly, are you saying that if the tax code were left on virtually unchanged, that the burden of taxation would shift more to middle-income people or lower?
So what I said so far is that if the tax code were unchanged, the burden would rise in the specific sense that the taxes would take a larger share of the average family's income. We also talk in the chapter about some shifts across the income distribution, but they're subtle and I won't get them right if I just offer them off the cuff. But basically, we take the features of the tax code very seriously, and particular features end up having different sorts of effects over time. So there is some shift across groups as well, but I don't want to try to recapitulate that.
Linda?
Early in the hour, you said that one obstacle to progress was getting the public to understand this, that the public, in the abstract, doesn't like federal spending, but in reality, they like their Social Security, Medicare, Medicaid. What can CBO do, outside the realm of politics to help the public understand the challenges?
I think our role is to serve the Congress. Okay. And we have a website that we devote some effort to make our work accessible to members and staff of the Congress, but thanks to the beauties of the web, are accessible to everyone anywhere in the country, anywhere in the world. And we get a lot of traffic, of course, from people off the Hill. So I think that by making our work for the Congress available more broadly, we are helping to educate people. But of course, the people who find their way to our website are going to be those who are disproportionately one might say, rather peculiarly interested in the federal budget. So it's, I don't think it's making a lot of headway on this overall issue. Before I came to CBO, when I was at Brookings, I participated a bit in a, something called the Fiscal Wake-Up Tour, which was led by David Walker when he was the Comptroller General, and included people from Brookings and Heritage, maybe some other think tank in town. And the tour went around the country. I only went on a few of these. But I think they visit almost every state, and they would go and talk to chambers of commerce and student groups and on local television and so on. And the idea was to teach people about the nature of the budget challenge.
Does it have any impact, these fiscal wake-up tours?
I don't know if it was measured. Again, I felt like the audience was disproportionately the people who were already going to the CBO website. So there's a little problem of preaching to the choir. Right. I don't know if they've ever tried to keep track of how much it mattered.
We're going to Jennifer because she hasn't had one. Yes, Jennifer.
Thank you. So going back to the shutdown and the potential economic effects, if we are looking at a shutdown, I guess last one was in the 90s, and it has this sort of similar effect on the budget in that range, at what point, how many weeks does it take for it to actually hurt the economy?
I'm afraid I don't have a crisp answer to that. I mean, I think the effects build over time. And 2 weeks is worse than 1 week, and 3 weeks is worse than two, and four is still worse than that. I don't have any calculations at hand about how much each week would be worth, and I would emphasize that in addition to these direct effects that probably do just sort of scale up, I think the matter issue of confidence, and whether the process ends with a sense that decisions have been made that will put the budget and the government on a better path, or whether the process ends with a sense of there's been disarray, I think can matter an awful lot for the economic effects. And that's not something that would scale up with a number of weeks, per se. It's a more amorphous but potentially important thing.
Can I ask a follow-up? Did it affect the economy when it happened in the 90s?
I think economists believe that it did, mm-hmm. but there are an awful lot of other things that go on that affect the economy from quarter to quarter. So if you look at GDP growth from quarter to quarter or industrial production growth or something else, pretty volatile. So it's often hard after the fact to go back and see the imprint of the particular thing that one's trying to focus on. And the way that we make our projections of the economic effects of changes in fiscal policy are not looking at any individual episode, but the entire corpus of economic research that draws on a lot of many episodes, but many of which are individually not very telling.
Is there anybody else who hasn't had one before we go to Brian for the last one? Seeing none, last question. All right.
Dutchess County.
Yeah.
In Dutchess County in New York State.
Are your parents still there? They are?
No, they're not.
Okay. You released a snap paper on Monday and said that the Republican bill would reduce the rolls by $14 million by 2023. Even without any policy change, would the rolls release? And then also, there's an enhanced benefit that expires November 1st that was part of the American Recovery Act. Is there any economic impact on that reduction, from that reduction?
So people understand, we released an estimate for this bill that the houses will be considering. We do think that even in the absence of this legislation, there would be decline in enrollment in SNAP, which is used to be known as food stamps. I don't remember the numbers offhand. I think we've shown this in our reports. I think we actually had a separate blog post about it a few months ago. I just don't remember what the numbers are. What the historical experience has shown is that during economic downturns, enrollment tends to rise, often sharply. In the wake of downturns, enrollment will decline, but much more gradually. So our projection is consistent with that historical experience. We do think that the expansion of benefits in the Recovery Act was a boost to the economy, and that the withdrawal of those benefits will be a negative factor for economic growth in the short term. But our estimates that we've done are for the Recovery Act as a whole, and we still are required by law to report, I think, twice a year on the economic effects of the Recovery Act. But we did for the law as a whole, again. And we looked, as we did that, we looked at the effects of different provisions, but we tried not to release numbers for specific provisions because they really are quite uncertain. And we think, though we build up the estimate in pieces, we think the best information we can provide is more of a rough sense of the overall effects. And in our reports have shown not only, I think, a focus really on ranges of effects, again, to try to convey the uncertainty that we have. But basically, putting money into the hands of people with a very high propensity to spend it is boosts demand in the short term. And the main factor that's weighing on the economy now and has weighed on the economy for the past few years has been a shortfall in the demand for goods and services. And businesses have responded to that shortfall in demand by not hiring workers. And that is the principal cause of the very high level of unemployment and the very low level of labor force participation relative to what the trends would be.
And for that, I think we're out of time. Thank you so much for doing that.
Happy to be here. Thank you all very much.
Thanks. Thanks for taking the time to do it.
This is good. Happy for that.